prosperous societies, or the high taxes that make large families prohibitively expensive in materially prosperous societies. But this is a little bit like arguing over which came first, the chicken or the egg, or, in this case, which came first, the lack of eggs or the scraggy old chicken-necked women desperate for one designer baby at the age of 48. Whether or not Russia, Japan, and Europe's fertility woes derive from abortion, what should be obvious is that the way the abortion issue is posited, as an issue of personal choice, is in and of itself symptomatic of the existential crisis of the dying West. In a traditional society, a 17th-century farming village, say, children are an advantage, not just economically, but in more general social ways. We're not doing a lot of 17th-century farming these days, so we need to find a way to restore advantage to parenthood in the context of a modern society. All we know is that the modern social democratic state is not the answer. The EU figures it needs another 50 million immigrants in the next few years just to maintain a big enough working population to fund the lavish social programs its vast retired army of baby boomers expects to enjoy. And the only available sources of immigrants are North Africa and the Middle East. Whether these are the chaps to keep Pierre and Gerhardt in the style to which they've become accustomed is highly doubtful. According to some Scandinavian statistics, 40% of those on welfare are immigrants. Elsewhere, the picture is similar. Welfare regimes work a lot better for their Islamist beneficiaries than for native continental ones. When one contemplates the demographic catastrophe, it's easy to say, well, maybe we should reduce the tax burden on young, fertile adults, make it easier for them to afford to buy a home and start a family. But the economic argument is, in the larger scheme, marginal. In traditional rural societies, children were a necessary insurance for one's old age. By the time you were too stooped and worn to plow the field and hunt for dinner, Junior would do it for you. Today, when you're stooped and worn, and in fact long before that point, the state steps in to take care of you. Reconnecting nanny state populations with cross-generational solidarity requires much more than the marginal tax breaks the Portuguese government announced, or the $9,000 the Russian state is now offering for second children. The most important action in reacquainting individuals with a larger sense of life is the one that governments recoil from: shrink the state. They could at least reorient as many benefits as possible toward children. In America, a lot of welfare is inadvertently natalist, albeit in not always helpful ways, like single motherhood. In the sense that for most of the big-time benefit gravy, you need babies. But those nations farther down the death spiral will need to embrace serious uber-natalism. For example, if you've got four dependents, your taxable income ought to be divided by five. An employed man with a stay-at-home wife and three children pays a fifth of what an employed single man does. If they both earn $50,000, the swinging bachelor pays tax on $50,000, which still leaves enough for him to hit the singles bars. The married stiff pays tax on $10,000, which makes a family affordable. Another constraint on family size is available housing. Acre for acre, America is the cheapest developed country in which to buy a big home, with plenty of space for plenty of kids. That helps explain why Canada's fertility rate is so European, partly for reasons of climate, but partly because of more recent Trudeaupian social developments and immigration trends. The Northern Dominion's population is more concentrated than America's, that is, more urban. If you were designing a master plan for Canada, you'd want to provide some way of encouraging still fecund young couples to move from their pokey Toronto and Vancouver apartments to the great outdoors. In Western Europe, the cost of housing is extraordinarily high. Whenever I read about the ever larger number of Italians in early middle age still living with mom and dad, I'm reminded of an old Benny Hill sketch in which he and his Dolly Bird are bikers who can't get public housing. The BBC interviewer says, "Why don't you move back in with your parents?" Benny grunts, "We would do, but they've moved back in with theirs." That gets closer to the nub of the matter. It's not just a question of tax breaks and affordable housing. The chief characteristic of our age is deferred adulthood. All over North America and Europe, there are millions of people going to college for no good reason. Certainly, there's no reason why the sum of knowledge the average American has accumulated by the time he's completed a bachelor's degree should take 20 years to inculcate. We need to redirect the system to telescope education into a much shorter period. Instead, we've implicitly accepted that our bodies mature much earlier than our great-grandparents, but that our minds don't. We enter adolescence much sooner and leave it much later, in some cases not until middle age. We've created a world where a 31-year-old European male can stroll into a nightclub, tell the babes he lives at his mom and dad's place, in the same bedroom he slept in since he was in diapers, and he can still walk out with a hot-looking date. This guy would have been a laughingstock at any other point in human history. The state and its citizens would be better off if we gave students a terrific high school education, and then let them get on with earning money so they can afford to have 2 or 3 kids in their 20s, instead of one fertility treatment special delivery in late middle age. It won't be easy to do that, particularly in America, where schools are a bastion of over-unionization, dedicated to expanding their privileges and protections at the expense of their pupils. But our refusal to rein in deferred adulthood is one reason why developed societies are ever more dependent on unsustainable levels of immigration. That includes the United States, where the Hispanicization of large parts of the country is setting up America for the most destabilizing aspects of bicultural and bilingual societies. By 2015, almost every viable political party in the West will be natalist, and the cannier ones will be supporting policies like a flat tax that help restore the societal architecture vandalized by careless governmental social engineering. As much as Europe and Islamism, social and fiscal policy are now a matter of national survival. In the end, it's not about cash. After all, materialism and self-gratification are why utopians gave up on the future in the first place. The best reason to diminish social programs is not to put more money in people's pockets, but to put more responsibility in people's pockets. Because if we don't, the unthinkable solutions are the only ones left. In his final book, the distinguished British commentator Anthony Sampson claimed that after September 11th, the fear of terrorism strengthened the hands of all governments. It certainly shouldn't have. In Hans Mondermann's Netherlands, they show some signs of acknowledging that the multi-culti pieties of the last 30 years were a dangerous fantasy. In the rest of the developed world, they're still larding it on. If America is to avoid the continent's fate, she needs to talk up self-reliance and individual innovation, instead of being sheepish, as Democrats often sound, that their Neanderthal citizenry aren't more enlightened and European. Free citizens have a shot at winning this existential struggle. Nanny state charges don't. The road ahead will be difficult enough. Cluttering it up with no parking signs isn't going to make it any safer. Chapter 10. The Falling Camel. Last Legs. Nature has made up her mind that what cannot defend itself shall not be defended. Ralph Waldo Emerson, Society and Solitude, 1870. This book isn't an argument for more war, more bombing, or more killing, but for more will. In a culturally confident age, the British in India were faced with the practice of sati, the tradition of burning widows on the funeral pyres of their husbands. General Sir Charles Napier was impeccably multicultural. You say that it is your custom to burn widows. Very well. We also have a custom. When men burn a woman alive, we tie a rope around their necks and we hang them. Build your funeral pyre. Beside it, my carpenters will build a gallows. You may follow your custom, and then we will follow ours. India today is better off without sati. If you don't agree with that, if you think that's just dead white male Eurocentrism, fine. But I don't think you really do believe that. Non-judgmental multiculturalism is an obvious fraud, and was subliminally accepted on that basis. After all, most adherents to the idea that all cultures are equal don't want to live in anything but an advanced Western society. Multiculturalism means your kid has to learn some wretched tribal dirge for the school holiday concert, instead of getting to sing Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, or that your holistic masseuse uses techniques developed from Native American spirituality. But not that you or anyone you care about should have to live in an African or Native American society. It's a quintessential piece of progressive humbug. But if you think you genuinely believe that sati is just an example of the rich, vibrant tapestry of indigenous cultures, you ought to consider what your pleasant suburb would be like if 25, 30, 48% of the people around you believed in it too. Multiculturalism was conceived by the Western elites not to celebrate all cultures, but to deny their own. It is thus the real suicide bomb. The rest of us, the ones who think you can make judgments about competing cultures on liberty, religious freedom, the rule of law, need to recover the cultural cool that General Napier demonstrated. Instead, as his first reaction to the controversy over those Danish cartoons, the EU's Justice and Security Minister, Franco Frattini, said that Europe would set up a media code to encourage prudence in the way they cover, certain sensitive subjects. As Signor Frattini explained it to the Daily Telegraph, the press will give the Muslim world the message, "We are aware of the consequences of exercising the right of free expression. We can and we are ready to self-regulate that right." Prudence? Self-regulate our free expression? No, I'm afraid that's just giving the Muslim world the message, "You've won. I surrender. Please stop kicking me." But they never do. Because, to use the Arabic proverb with which Robert Ferrigno opens his novel, Prayers for the Assassin, a falling camel attracts many knives. In Denmark and France, the Netherlands and Britain, Islam senses the camel is falling, and this is no time to stop knifing him. Or, as Simeon Howard said in a sermon preached to the Ancient and Honorable Artillery Company in Boston in 1773, "An incautious people may submit to these demands, one after another, till its liberty is irrecoverably gone, before they saw the danger. Injuries, small in themselves, may in their consequences be fatal to those who submit to them, especially if they are persisted in. And, with respect to such injuries, we should ever act upon that ancient maxim of prudence, obsta principis. The first unjust demands of an encroaching power should be firmly withstood. When there appears a disposition to repeat and increase such demands, and oftentimes it may be both the right and duty of a people to engage in war rather than give up to the demands of such a power what they could, without any inconveniency, spare in the way of charity. War, though a great evil, is ever preferable to such concessions, as are likely to be fatal to public liberty." After the Madrid bombing, The Spectator, the oldest continuously published magazine in the English language, ran an editorial headlined, "We Are Not at War." They wished to assure Britons that the jihad would not be taking possession of Buckingham Palace. Osama bin Laden is no more likely to march triumphantly down the mall than is a little green man from Mars. Al-Qaeda has means, but no end. Well, no. Osama won't be going down the mall and through the palace gates, unless it's his surviving granules of DNA on a gun carriage. But it doesn't have to be that dramatic. The Al-Qaeda Air Force won't be having dogfights with the RAF over the White Cliffs of Dover before the Queen signs the instrument of abdication in the presence of the acting first Ayatollah of the Islamic Republic of Britain. Yet you can reach the same point of surrender very gradually, almost imperceptibly. In that respect, the editors of The Spectator have it exactly backward. Al-Qaeda haven't the means, but their end, the Islamification of the West, is shared by millions of law-abiding Muslims. Recall one of the most famous images of terror from Joseph Conrad's great novel, The Secret Agent, 1907, and its signature scene of the lone terrorist padding the streets of London with a bomb strapped to his chest. He had no future. He disdained it. He was a force. His thoughts caressed the images of ruin and destruction. He walked frail, insignificant, shabby, miserable, and terrible in the simplicity of his idea, calling madness and despair to the regeneration of the world. Nobody looked at him. He passed on unsuspected and deadly, like a pest in the street full of men. The power of the image lies in the bomber's isolation from the tide of Londoners all around him, all blissfully unaware. But, as became clear very quickly after the 2005 tube bombings, that's not quite the world we live in. It's not black, the bomber, and white, the rest of us. There's a lot of murky shades of gray in between. The terrorist bent on devastation and destruction prowls the streets, while around him are a significant number of people urging him on, and around them a larger group of cocksure young male co-religionists gleefully celebrating mass murder, and around them a much larger group of moderates who stand silent at the acts committed in their name, and around them a mesh of religious and community leaders openly inciting treason against the state, and around them another mesh of religious and community leaders who serve as apologists for the inciters, and around them a network of professional identity group grievance mongers, adamant that they're the real victims, and around them a vast mass of elite opinion in the media and elsewhere, too squeamish about ethno-cultural matters to confront reality, and around them a political establishment desperate to pretend this is just a managerial problem that can be finessed away with a few new laws and a bit of community outreach. It's these insulating circles of gray, the imams, lobby groups, media, bishops, politicians, that bulk up the loser death cult and make it a potent force. And way out at the end of this chain of shades of gray is the general population. And sometimes enough of them bleed into the gray blur of passivity and defeatism, as in Spain. Sometimes they don't, yet, as in America. And sometimes, as in the United Kingdom, they talk about defiance and the old Blitz spirit, but they make 1,000 trivial concessions day by day. That's how great nations die, not by war or conquest, but bit by bit, until one day you wake up and you don't need to sign a formal instrument of surrender because you did it piecemeal over the last 10 years. So, unlike Conrad's lone bomber, this enemy is able to hide in plain sight, a pest in a street full of pests, in an America where half the political establishment wants to upgrade enemies into defendants with their day in court and full legal rights, in a Europe paralyzed by fear of its own immigrant populations, in a Western world whose media dignify our killers as militants, activists, and insurgents, why do they hate us was never the right question. Why do they despise us is a better one. After the carnage in Spain, Sheikh Omar Bakri Mohammed told Lisbon's Publica magazine that a group of London Islamists were ready to launch a big operation on British soil. "We don't make a distinction between civilians and non-civilians, innocents and non-innocents," he said, clarifying the ground rules. "Only between Muslims and unbelievers, and the life of an unbeliever has no value." The cleric added he expected to see the banner of Islam flying in Downing Street. "I believe one day that is going to happen, because this is my country. I like living here," he said. "If they believe in democracy, who are they afraid of? Let Omar Bakri benefit from democracy." You think that sounds ridiculous? The Islamic Crescent flying over 10 Downing Street? You'd be surprised how quickly the question of what flag should fly over government buildings can become an issue. In 2005, Anne Owers, Her Majesty's Chief Inspector of Prisons, banned the flying of the English national flag in English prisons on the grounds that it shows the cross of St. George, which was used by the Crusaders and so is offensive to Muslims. The Drivers and Vehicles Licensing Agency has also banned the English flag from its offices. So has Heathrow Airport. So Britain's already crept a little way toward the spectators' allegedly as kooky as men from Mars scenario. The old flag's unflyable, de facto, if not quite de jure, and it's just a matter of what new and appropriate multicultural swatch is selected to fly in its place. If it were just terrorists bombing buildings and public transit, it would be easier. Even the feeblest Euro-wimp jurisdiction is obliged to act when the street is piled with corpses. But there's an old technique well understood by the smarter bullies. If you want to break a man, don't attack him head-on. Don't brutalize him. Pain and torture can awaken a stubborn resistance in all but the weakest. But just make him slightly uncomfortable, disrupt his life at the margin, and he'll look for the easiest path to renormalization. There are fellows rampaging through the streets because of some cartoons? Why, surely the most painless solution would be if we all agreed not to publish such cartoons. Fast-moving demographic changes provide immense challenges for any society. In the wake of the "No Mexican Left Behind, Illegal Immigration, Come On Down" bonanza passed by the Senate and cheered by the President in 2006, National Review's John Derbyshire noted the enrollment statistics for his school district on suburban Long Island, 1,400 miles from the southern border. High school, 17% Hispanic. Intermediate, 28% Hispanic. Elementary, 31% Hispanic. There's no jihad, no honor killings, no polygamy issues with Latinos. But transformative demographic trends, at the very minimum, impose huge costs, even for quiet communities far from the political front lines. Derbyshire's numbers suggest that at some point, every school board in America will have to factor in ever-swelling bilingual and other related education programs. That's aside from the bigger cultural shifts, less easy to quantify in budgetary line items. You might say, as open borders advocates do, "Oh well, the American idea is so strong that all those 31% grade school Hispanics will be perfectly assimilated by the time they're in high school." Maybe. To put it at its mildest, that requires taking a very optimistic view of the assimilationist power of contemporary multiculturalism. Now put yourself in Europe's shoes, up against a surging demographic more self-segregating and more explicitly opposed to the continent's cultural and political inheritance. Will plus demography is a potent combination. It's why you can't dismiss Sheikh Omar Bakri Mohammed as a fringe nutcake, because he can command just enough support from enough people to put just enough of what he wants just within the realm of political possibility. After September 11th, the first reaction of just about every prominent Western leader was to visit a mosque. President Bush did, so did the Prince of Wales, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, the Prime Minister of Canada, and many more. And when the get-me-to-the-mosque-on-time fever died away, you couldn't help feeling that this would strike almost any previous society as, well, bizarre. Pearl Harbor's been attacked? Quick, order some sushi and get me into a matinee of Madame Butterfly. Seeking to reassure the co-religionists of those who attack you that you do not regard them all as the enemy is a worthy aim, but a curious first priority. And, given that more than a few of the imams in those mosque photo ops turned out to be, at best, equivocal on the matter of Islamic terrorism, and at worst, somewhat enthusiastic supporters of it, it involved way too much self-deception on our part. But it set the tone for all that followed, to the point where with each bomb or plot, from September 11th to London to Toronto, the protestations of Islam's good faith grew ever more fulsome. Minority rights doctrine, wrote British author Melanie Phillips, has produced a moral inversion in which those doing wrong are excused if they belong to a victim group, while those at the receiving end of their behavior are blamed simply because they belong to the oppressive majority. It is impossible to overstate the importance, not just to Britain, but to the global struggle against Islamist extremism, of properly understanding and publicly challenging this moral, intellectual, and philosophical inversion, which translates aggressor into victim, and vice versa. Consider the name given to the current conflict, War on Terror. Wait a minute, aren't wars usually waged against named enemies? Yes, but to the progressive mind, the very concept of the enemy is obsolescent. There are no enemies, just friends whose grievances we haven't yet accommodated. In part, it's societal forgetfulness. In an electronic age, a present-tense culture, we assume that social progress is like technological progress. It can't be reversed. Just as you can't disinvent the internal combustion engine, so you can't disinvent women's rights. Just as the horse and buggy yielded to the steam train and the Ford Model T and the passenger jet, so the advanced social democratic society will march onward to state daycare and 30-hour work weeks and gay marriage and even greater ethnic diversity. And nothing can turn it back, certainly not a lot of 7th-century weirdbeards. Many of us figure the Islamist plan to reestablish the caliphate is the equivalent of that moment in the SpongeBob SquarePants movie when Plankton roars, "I'm going to rule the world." Towering over him, SpongeBob says, "Good luck with that." But you never know. It might be that we're the plankton. Our enemies are small worms, Adolf Hitler told his generals in August 1939. I saw them at Munich. In Europe today, as in the 30s, the political class prostrates itself before an insatiable force that barely acknowledges the latest surrender before moving on to the next invented grievance. Indeed, a formal enemy is all but superfluous to requirements. Bomb us, and we agonize over the root causes. Decapitate us, and our politicians rush to the nearest mosque to declare that Islam is a religion of peace. Issue blood-curdling calls at Friday prayers to kill all the Jews and infidels, and we fret that it may cause a backlash against Muslims. Behead sodomites and mutilate female genitalia, and gay groups and feminist groups can't wait to march alongside you, denouncing Bush and Blair. Murder a school full of children, and our scholars explain that to the vast majority of Muslims, jihad is a harmless concept, meaning healthy lifestyle, low-fat granola bar. Thus, the lopsided vals macabre of our times. The more the Islamists step on our toes, the more we waltz them gaily round the room. As French philosopher Jean-François Ravel wrote, "Clearly a civilization that feels guilty for everything it is and does will lack the energy and conviction to defend itself." During the cartoon jihad, the New York Times gave a routinely pompous explanation of why it would not be showing us the representations of the Prophet. Sensitive news organizations, the editors explained, had the duty to refrain from gratuitous assaults on religious symbols. The very next day, the Times illustrated a story on the Danish controversy with a piece of New York art from a couple of seasons earlier, showing the Virgin Mary covered in elephant dung. Multiculturalism seems to operate on the same even-handedness as the old Cold War joke, in which the American tells the Soviet guy that, "In my country, everyone is free to criticize the president." And the Soviet guy replies, "Same here. In my country, everyone is free to criticize your president." Under the rules as understood by the New York Times, the West is free to mock and belittle its Judeo-Christian inheritance, and, likewise, the Muslim world is free to mock and belittle the West's Judeo-Christian inheritance. If one has to choose, on balance, Islam's loathing of other cultures seems psychologically less damaging than the Western elite's loathing of their own. Insurgencies, whether explicitly terrorist or more subtle, persist because of a lack of confidence on the part of their targets. The IRA, for example, calculated correctly that the British had the capability to smash them totally, but not the will. So they knew that while they could never win militarily, they also could never be defeated. The Islamists have figured similarly. The only difference is that most terrorist wars are highly localized. We now have the first truly global terrorist insurgency because the Islamists view the whole world the way the IRA views the bogs of Fermanagh. They want it, and they've calculated that our entire civilization lacks the will to see them off. Granted, at a certain level, that's preposterous. There's a contradiction at the heart of Islamist confidence, nicely caught in a story from New Zealand about female Muslims driving around in burqas. According to some police representatives, this mode of dress somewhat restricts the field of vision, and also offers opportunities for fleeing bank robbers to disguise themselves as Muslim women. However, nobody wants to be insensitive, do they? And, on the whole, the police were happy to take the Islamic lobby groups at their word that the burqa was a requirement of these women's faith. But as Greg O'Connor, president of the New Zealand Police Association, couldn't resist adding, "If one's belief system was so strong that you didn't want to show one's face, then perhaps that belief system should extend to not driving." Indeed, if your clothing can't evolve out of the camel train era, maybe your mode of transportation shouldn't either. But that's Islam in the third millennium. They want the certainties of 7th century society with the conveniences of the 21st century. It doesn't work like that, of course. An Islamic States of America, an Islamic Republic of France, an Islamic Kingdom of Belgium, an Islamic Dominion of Canada would all very quickly be societies in decline, living on the accumulated capital of their pre-Muslim past, as indeed much of Islam did at its zenith. But do we really want to test that proposition? Simply, as a matter of fact, every year more and more of the world lives under Islamic law. Pakistan adopted Islamic law in 1977, Iran in 1979, Sudan in 1984. In the 60s, Nigeria lived under English common law. Now, half of it's in the grip of Sharia, and the other half's feeling the squeeze. Today, there are more Muslim nations, more radicalized Muslims within those nations, more and more Muslims within non-Muslim nations, and more Muslims represented in more and more influential transnational institutions. Will these Muslims live by the laws of Singapore or Denmark or New Zealand, or by the laws of Islam? Or is their primary identity a new worldwide Islamic identity? To ask the question is in large part to answer it. Even if a Muslim wanted to, how would he assimilate with, say, Canadian national identity? You can't assimilate with a nullity, which is what the modern multicultural state boils down to. It's much easier to dismantle a society than to put anything new and lasting in its place. And across much of the developed world, that's what's going on right now. Multiculturalism makes a nation no more than a holding pen. In the absence of cultural confidence, demography will decide the future. Or, in the unimprovable summation of James C. Bennett, democracy, immigration, multiculturalism. Pick any two. At the heart of multiculturalism is a lie, that all cultures are equally valid. To accept that proposition means denying reality, the reality of any objective measure of human freedom, societal health, and global population movement. Multiculturalism is not the first ideology founded on the denial of truth. You'll recall Hermann Goering's memorable assertion that 2 plus 2 makes 5 if the Führer wills it. Likewise, we're asked to accept that the United States Constitution was modeled on the principles of the Iroquois Confederation, if a generation of multi-culti theorists, the ethnic grievance lobby, and even a ludicrous resolution of the United States Congress so wills it. Still, it's harmless, isn't it? What's wrong with playing make-believe if it helps us all feel warm and fuzzy about each other? Well, because it's never helpful to put reality up for grabs. There may come a day when you need it. Look at the photograph that appeared on the front of a Fleet Street tabloid shortly after the London Tube bombings. A quartet of young men enjoying a weekend's whitewater rafting in Wales. A mini-vacation the killers took to prepare themselves for blowing the underground to bits. Outwardly, these blokes were no different from any other Yorkshire lads of their age, weaned on chips, fond of cricket, garbed in revolting Brit leisure wear. The London bombers were, to the naked eye, almost perfectly assimilated, at least in respect to sports, fashion, and pop music. The only difference was inside, a willingness to slaughter dozens of their fellow Britons in the interests of the jihad. They'd adopted so many trees that nobody could see they lacked the big, overarching forest, the essence of identity, of allegiance. If Islamist extremism is the genie you're trying to put back in the bottle, it doesn't help to have smashed the bottle. At the core of multiculturalism is an assumption that a non-Western culture is somehow primal and immutable, but that an advanced nation is no more than the sum of its constituent parts. It's a kind of societal Stockholm syndrome, a desperation to identify with anything that comes along other than your own. The great thing about multiculturalism is that it doesn't involve knowing anything about other cultures. The capital of Bhutan? The principal exports of Malaysia? Who cares? That's the stuff the old imperialist Wallahs used to be well up on. But multiculturalism just involves feeling warm and fluffy about everyone, making bliss out of ignorance. If the guy's rich, vibrant cultural tradition involves standing over you with a scimitar shouting, "Allahu Akbar," well, you can't complain you're not getting your share of cultural diversity. Given the growing Muslim populations in Europe and the remarkable success hitherto obscure Muslim lobby groups have had in constraining certain aspects of the war on terror, it seems almost certain that Islamist political parties will arise in the continent within the next decade. And, given the very few degrees of separation between very prominent Western Muslims, ambassadors, princes, professors, and the terrorists, it seems likely that many prominent figures in these parties will be supportive of the terrorists' ends. And given the governing principle of multicultural society, that Western man demonstrates his cultural sensitivity by preemptively surrendering, any smart Islamist, surveying the Madrid bombing and the aftermath, must be contemplating the benefits of a twin-track strategy. There are three possible resolutions to the present struggle. 1. Submit to Islam. 2. Destroy Islam. 3. Reform Islam. Because most of us don't take number 1 as a serious possibility, we're equally unserious about being forced to choose between 2 and 3. But submission to Islam is very possible, and to many, it will still seem ridiculous even as it happens. Like John Kerry during the 2004 campaign, we'll be spluttering that we can't believe we're losing to these idiots. But we can lose, as I've always believed, and, as I've come to believe, we might lose more easily than even the gloomiest of us thought. By "we might lose," I mean the good guys, and I define that term expansively. There are plenty of good guys in Australia and Poland and Iraq and even Pakistan, and I'm a little unnerved at the number of readers who seem to think that the rest of the world can go hang, but America will endure as a lonely candle of liberty in the new dark ages. Think that one through. A totalitarian China, a crumbling Russia, an insane Middle East, a disease-ridden Africa, a civil war-torn Arabia, and a country that can't even enforce its borders against two relatively benign states will somehow be able to hold the entire planet at bay? Dream on, realists. As for option 2, it doesn't bear thinking about. Even if you regard Islam as essentially incompatible with free societies, the slaughter required to end it as a force in the world would change America beyond recognition. That doesn't mean that a few years down the line, if some kooks with nukes obliterate, say, Marseille or Lyon, that the French won't give it a go in some fairly spectacular way. But they're unlikely to accomplish much by it, any more than the Russians have by their scorched-earth strategy in Chechnya. That leaves option 3, reform Islam, which is not ours to do. Ultimately, only Muslims can reform Islam. All the free world can do is create conditions that increase the likelihood of Muslim reform, or at any rate, do not actively impede it. We can, 1. Support women's rights, real rights, not feminist pieties, in the Muslim world. This is the biggest vulnerability in Islam. Not every Muslim female wants to be Gloria Steinem or Paris Hilton, but nor do they want a life that starts with genital mutilation and ends with an honor killing at the hands of your brothers. The overwhelming majority of females in continental battered women's shelters are Muslim, which gives you some sense of what women in the Middle East might do if they had any women's shelters to go to. When half the population of these societies is a potential source of dissent, we need to use it. 2. Roll back Wahhabi, Iranian, and other ideological exports that have radicalized Muslims on every continent. We have an ideological enemy, and we need to wage ideological war. 3. Support economic and political liberty in the Muslim world, even if it means unsavory governments. An elected unsavory government is still better than a dictatorial unsavory government. It's not necessary for Syria and Egypt to become Minnesota and New Zealand. All that's necessary is for them to become something other than what they are now. And on the bumpy road to liberty, every Muslim regime that has to preoccupy itself with internal dissent has less time to foment trouble beyond its borders. 4. Ensure that Islamic states that persecute non-Muslims are denied international legitimacy and excluded and marginalized in international bodies. 5. Throttle the funding of mosques, madrasas, think tanks, and other activities in America and elsewhere by Saudi Arabia, Iran, and others. 6. Develop a strategy for countering Islamism on the ideological front. Create a civil corps to match America's warrior corps, and use it to promote alternative institutions, structures, and values through a post-imperial equivalent to Britain's colonial office, albeit under whatever wussy name is deemed acceptable, Department of Global Community Outreach, or whatever. This, by the way, is what Washington should have created, instead of the bloated bureaucracy of the Department of Homeland Security. 7. Marginalize and euthanize the UN, NATO, the International Atomic Energy Agency, and other September 10th transnational organizations, and devote the energy wasted on them to results-oriented multilateralism. We need real allies now. 8. Cease bankrolling unreformable oil dictatorships by a long-overdue transformation of the energy industry. 9. End the Iranian regime. 10. Strike militarily when the opportunity presents itself. Aside from numbers 9 and 10, these are important but undramatic objectives. That is, the kind of stuff our side does very badly. The problem with redesignating the war on terror as the Long War is that it's easy for it to degenerate a step further and lapse into non-war mode entirely. But what are the alternatives? Retreat behind Fortress America? What fortress? The one Congress built on the Rio Grande as a Latino welcome center? The hyperpower has to be engaged with the world, if only because splendid isolation is rarely seen as such by others. What was the biggest single factor in the radicalization of young British Muslims? The then conservative government's conclusion in the 1990s that it had no dog in the Balkans junkyard. As Osama bin Laden put it, "The British are responsible for destroying the caliphate system. They are the ones who created the Palestinian problem. They are the ones who created the Kashmiri problem. They are the ones who put the arms embargo on the Muslims of Bosnia so that 2 million Muslims were killed." How did a list of imperial interventions wind up with that bit of non-imperial non-intervention? Because for great powers, detachment from the affairs of the world is not an option. Even-handedness by Washington will be received as a form of one-handedness by the time its effects are felt in Wakistan or Basket-Casia. Isolation doesn't travel. Americans and other Westerners who want their families to enjoy the blessings of life in a free society should understand that the life we've led since 1945 in the Western world is very rare in human history. Our children are unlikely to enjoy anything so placid, and may well spend their adult years in an ugly and savage world, unless we decide that who and what we are is worth defending. To a 5-year-old boy watching Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee procession on the Mall in 1897, it would have been inconceivable that by the time of his 80th birthday, the greatest empire the world had ever known would have sunk to an economically moribund, strike-bound slough of despond, whose tax rates drove its best talents abroad, and whose most glittering colonial possessions now valued ties to communist Russia over those to the mother country. It's difficult to focus on long-term trends, because human life is itself short-term. So think short-term. Huge changes are underway right now. The threat to U.S. power comes not principally from Chinese innovation or Indian engineering graduates, but from America's own cultural indolence. Just as the sack of Rome was a symptom of the fall of the empire rather than the cause, the governing class found themselves, to quote Cole Porter, fighting vainly the old ennui. And that's harder to do than fighting off an invading army. Bernard Lewis, the West's preeminent scholar of Islam, worked for British intelligence through the grimmest hours of World War II. In 1940, we knew who we were. We knew who the enemy was. We knew the dangers and the issues, he told the Wall Street Journal. In our island, we knew we would prevail, that the Americans would be drawn into the fight. It is different today. We don't know who we are, we don't know the issues, and we still do not understand the nature of the enemy. The advantage for the United States, and, to a lesser extent, other parts of the English-speaking world, is that Europe is ahead in the line, and its fate may wake up even the most blinkered on this side of the Atlantic. Islamism is militarily weak, but ideologically confident. The West is militarily strong, but ideologically insecure. The suicide bomber is a symbol of weakness, of a culture so comprehensively failed that what ought to be its greatest resource, its people, is instead as disposable as a firecracker. But in our self-doubt, the enemy's weakness becomes his strength. We simply can't comprehend someone like Raed Abdelmask, pictured in the papers in 2004 with a big smile, a checkered shirt, and two cute little cherubs, a boy and a girl, in his arms. His wife was 5 months pregnant with their third child. So he kissed her goodbye, and then, big, smiling Raed, strapped an 11-pound bomb packed with nails and shrapnel to his chest, and boarded the number 2 bus in Jerusalem. We heard a lot about root causes in the weeks after September 11th, mostly the usual ones, poverty breeds despair, etc. But the September 11th murderers were middle class and educated, which is one reason why they were so skilled at their job that day. It was carefully plotted. They hijacked long-haul flights with the most fuel, at the time of day when airport security would be even more careless than usual. It was brilliantly planned, superbly executed. The perpetrators trained to become jet pilots, a profession that would guarantee a good life anywhere around the world. They could be pulling down 6-figure salaries instead of Manhattan skyscrapers. But they went to pilot school and trained in a highly disciplined fashion so they could make one flight, one time, one way, into a tall building. We cannot fathom men such as Mohammed Atta and Raed Abdelmask. But if you were the late Messrs. Mask and Atta, following events in North America and Europe, wouldn't we strike them as a little odd, too? When we hear about some guy in a cave dreaming of the new caliphate, we think he's nuts. But if you were in the cave watching a CNN bulletin in which legal analysts explain why the U.S. Supreme Court decided to confer Geneva Convention rights on unlawful combatants under an unprecedented reading of Common Article 3, or watching New York Times executives explain proudly how important it was for them to reveal fatally damaging details of a national security terror tracking program for no good reason whatsoever, wouldn't you conclude that we're the ones who are nuts? If you'd been in the cave and had your radio tuned to National Public Radio for the following exchange, wouldn't you have been splitting your sides, and not because your suicide bomber belt went off early? This was an interview on NPR's Morning Edition with the mayor of Toronto after the arrest of 17 alleged terrorist plotters. I was laughing so much I drove off the road. There ought to be a health warning before these cockamamie public broadcasting gag fests. His Honor David Miller warmed up with a bit of boilerplate Islamo-schmoozing. You know, in Islam, if you kill one person, you kill everybody. It's a very peaceful religion, and they're as shocked as Torontonians are. And Renee Montaigne, the NPR anchorette, instantly spotted the ghastly breach of PC etiquette and leapt in. Well, they sort of are Torontonians, she pointed out. Sorry, gulped the mayor, hastily re-smothering Muslims within the great diversity quilt. They're shocked as every Torontonian is. Ms. Montaigne then expressed bafflement that these allegedly alleged fellows would have wanted to commit a terrorist atrocity in what was, compared to the great Satan next door, a very open society, very liberal immigration policy, very good social services. Mayor Miller agreed. More than half of the people who live in Toronto, including myself, were not born in Canada, and I think that's why Canada works. Although it didn't work in this case, Ms. Montaigne noted, somewhat maliciously. Well, we don't expect these kinds of occurrences, exactly because of our public services, because of diversity. Blah, blah, blah. Insofar as there's any relation between jihadists and good social services, the latter seem to attract the former, at least in the sense that the Millennium Bomber, the Shoe Bomber, the Tube Bombers, etc., were all products of the Euro-Canadian welfare system. But go ahead, pretend that these guys were upset about insufficient social services, that they wanted to behead the Prime Minister to highlight the fact that wait times for the beheaded at the Toronto General are now up to 18 months, and they don't always reattach the right head. It's easy to scoff that a chap who can be bothered to blow up the Canadian Parliament must be insane. But if you were a jihadist sitting in the cave back in the Hindu Kush, listening to René Montaigne and David Miller compete to abase themselves before the most irrelevant PC platitudes, wouldn't you conclude that they're way more suicidal than you and Ahmed? A suicide bomber may be a weak weapon, but not against a suicide culture. The sickbed. Shortly after September 11th, I reread an old potboiler I vaguely remembered from my childhood. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes, had a sick wife, and in 1895 they went to Egypt, hoping the climate would alleviate her tuberculosis. No writer likes to waste local color, so in 1898 Conan Doyle published The Tragedy of the Carrasco, the story of a party of Anglo-American French tourists on a trip up the Nile, who wind up getting kidnapped by the Al-Qaeda of the day, the followers of the Mahdi. What's striking is how familiar it all is. The sudden intrusion of an unbending savagery upon modern man. When, but a year before, he had wandered under the elms of Cambridge, surely the last fate upon this earth which he could have predicted for himself would be that he should be slain by the bullet of a fanatical Mohammedan in the wilds of the Libyan desert. Even the techniques are much the same. "What do you suppose that they will do with us, Cochrane?" he asked after a pause. "They may cut our throats, or they may take us as slaves to Khartoum. I don't know that there is much to choose." Then, as now, the Islamists believe the infidels are looking at things back to front, that the advanced scientific mind is, in fact, an effete, arrogant weakness in the face of unquestioning faith. "As to the learning of which you speak, my lamb," said the mullah, in answer to some argument of Fardais, "I have myself studied at the University of Al-Azhar, at Cairo, and I know that to which you allude. But the learning of the faithful is not as the learning of the unbeliever, and it is not fitting that we pry too deeply into the ways of Allah. Some stars have tails, O my sweet lamb, and some have not. But what does it profit us to know which are which? For God made them all, and they are very safe in his hands. Therefore, my friend, be not puffed up by the foolish learning of the West, and understand that there is only one wisdom, which consists in following the will of Allah, as his chosen prophet has laid it down for us in this book. And now, my lambs, I see that you are ready to come into Islam." And in the face of such clarity, there are among the tourists those who take refuge in conspiracy theories. Just as many Westerners believe Bush cooked up the whole war on terror scam as a pretext to invade Afghanistan and Iraq, so at the beginning of Conan Doyle's adventure, a character believes the Mahdists have been concocted by the British government to provide a pretext for intervention. I repeat that there are no dervishes. They were an invention of Lord Cromer in the year 1885. "You don't say," cried Headingley. "It is well known in Paris, and has been exposed in La Patrie and other of our so well-informed papers." And when the conspiracy theorist is kidnapped and learns that there are, indeed, dervishes, his initial reaction, like those of the misnamed Christian peacemaker teams seized in Iraq, is how to emphasize how much he agrees with their point of view. The Frenchman waved his unwounded hand as he walked. "Vive la Khalifa! Vive la Mahdi!" he shouted, until a blow from behind with the butt end of a Remington beat him into silence. For, as did the kidnappers of those Iraqi peacemakers, the dervishes see even a supportive infidel only as an infidel. So what is the difference between a late Victorian shocker and our time? Conan Doyle's Britons and Americans and Europeans were men and women of the modern world, even then. None of them, except perhaps Miss Adams and Mrs. Belmont, had any deep religious convictions. All of them were children of this world, and some of them disagreed with everything which that symbol upon the earth represented. Yet in the end, the English, Irish, and Americans among the party have an instinctive civilizational confidence. They respect their foe, in part because they understand that's what he is. It was an odd sensation rereading the tragedy of the Carrasco after September 11th. As innumerable Western academics lined up across the TV studios and public prints to insist that poverty breeds desperation, I came across this passage. "It isn't safe to reckon upon a dervish's fears," remarked Brown. "We must always bear in mind that they are not amenable to the same motives as other people. Many of them are anxious to meet death, and all of them are absolute, uncompromising believers in destiny. They exist as a reductio ad absurdum of all bigotry, a proof of how surely it leads towards blank barbarism." It is absurd. How can the most advanced society in human history fall to a bunch of ignorant death cultists? Well, who do you think advanced societies do fall to? Something worse, something barbarous, something that's prepared to fight when you're not. 108 years later, there was a latter-day Cook's Tour atrocity in Egypt, a terrorist bombing at the popular Western holiday destination of Dahab. Egyptians were polled as to whom was responsible. 4% thought it was Al-Qaeda, 21% thought it was internal terrorist groups, 49% thought it was the Mossad. Denial really is a river in Egypt. How many Egyptians or Arabs or Muslims living in, say, Brussels or London or Dearborn, Michigan, feel the same? The key difference between the Anglo-American hostages in the tragedy of the Carrasco and their successors today is that they accepted their obligations. It's never easy, and certainly not for Conan Doyle's dramatis personae in 1898, when the white man's burden seemed especially burdensome. "It's my opinion that we have been the policemen of the world long enough. We policed the seas for pirates and slavers. Now we police the land for dervishes and brigands and every sort of danger to civilization. There is never a mad priest or a witch doctor or a firebrand of any sort on this planet who does not report his appearance by sniping the nearest British officer. One tires of it at last. If a Kurd breaks loose in Asia Minor, the world wants to know why Great Britain does not keep him in order. If there is a military mutiny in Egypt or a jihad in the Sudan, it is still Great Britain who has to set it right. And all to an accompaniment of curses, such as the policeman gets when he seizes a ruffian among his pals. We get hard knocks and no thanks. And why should we do it? Let Europe do its own dirty work." "Well," said Colonel Cochrane, crossing his legs and leaning forward with the decision of a man who has definite opinions, "I don't at all agree with you, Brown, and I think that to advocate such a course is to take a very limited view of our national duties. I think that behind national interests and diplomacy and all that, there lies a great guiding force, a providence, in fact, which is forever getting the best out of each nation and using it for the good of the whole. When a nation ceases to respond, it is time that she went into hospital for a few centuries, like Spain or Greece. The virtue has gone out of her. A man or a nation is not placed upon this earth to do merely what is pleasant and what is profitable. It is often called upon to carry out what is both unpleasant and unprofitable. But if it is obviously right, It is mere shirking not to undertake it. We have been shirking too long, and that's unworthy of a great civilization. To see off the new Dark Ages will be tough and demanding. The alternative will be worse. This concludes the reading of America Alone, The End of the World as We Know It, by Mark Stein. Copyright 2006 by Mark Stein. This book was read by Brian Emerson. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Regnery Publishing, Incorporated, and was produced in 2006 by Blackstone Audio, Incorporated, which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Incorporated.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.